Morning. This is Pastor Bill Roberts of the Terre Haute Reformed Presbyterian Church, 1407 North 25th Street in Terre Haute. We're studying through Luke, and we're ready to, in chapter 22 to read verses 24 to 46. This is near the end of Jesus' earthly life and ministry, and God is speaking to us in His Word. A dispute also rose among them, that's the 12 apostles, as to which of them was to be regarded as the greatest. And he said to them, "The kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them, and those in authority over them are called benefactors. But not so with you. Rather, let the greatest among you become as the youngest, and the leader is the one who serves. For who is greater, one who reclines at table, or the one who serves? Is it not the one who reclines at table? But I am among you as the one who serves. You are those who have stayed with me in my trials. And I assign to you, as my Father assigned to me, a kingdom, that you may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom and sit on thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. Simon, Simon, behold, Satan has demanded to have you, that he might sift you like wheat. But I have prayed for you, that your faith may not fail. And when you've turned again, strengthen your brothers." Peter said to him, "Lord, I'm ready to go with you both to prison and to death." Jesus said, "I tell you, Peter, the rooster will not crow this day until you deny three times that you know me." And he said to them, "When I sent you out with no money bag or knapsack or sandals, did you lack anything?" They said, "Nothing." And he said to them, "But now, let the one who has a money bag take it, and likewise a knapsack. And let the one who has no sword sell his cloak and buy one. For I tell you that the scriptures must be fulfilled, and he was numbered with the transgressors. For what is written about me has its fulfillment." And they said, "Look, Lord, here are two swords." And he said to them, "It is enough." And he came and went, as was his custom, to the Mount of Olives, and his disciples followed him. And when he came to the place, he said to them, "Pray that you may not enter into temptation." And he withdrew from them about a stone's throw, and knelt down and prayed, saying, "Father, if you're willing, remove this cup from me. Nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done." There appeared to him an angel from heaven, strengthening him. And being in agony, he prayed more earnestly. And his sweat became like great drops of blood falling down to the ground. And when he rose from prayer, he came to the disciples and found them sleeping for sorrow. And he said to them, "Why are you sleeping? Rise and pray that you may not enter into temptation." We have a great detailed account about the last day of Jesus' life here on earth that culminated his death on the cross. And I suggest to you that it's the most important and greatest day in the history of the world. And as you might think that this day would go along and Jesus would be getting along well with his followers and having a good time of eating last meal together, we hear a strident note in verse 24 and following. There's a concern for greatness. Which one of them would be greatest? Jesus is about to undergo the greatest trial ever. And they're thinking about who's going to have the best seats, who's going to be regarded as the greatest of them. And so the first point we can see is our concern with greatness and the typical view of greatness. We see in verse 24 a dispute as to which of them should be regarded as greatest. And we don't know what has brought this on. Maybe it's the way they've been seated at the table, and Judas has been given a position of honor. And maybe they're wondering why, you know, does he have a higher place than they thought? But it also seems to have been a constant sort of theme among them. Back in chapter 9 of Luke, they discussed, you know, which one's going to be greatest. And Jesus tries to answer them by taking a child and putting him in their midst. And saying, you need to be like that child. The mother of the sons of Zebedee wants places of honor for her two sons, James and John, the right and left hand of Jesus. And Jesus responds, it's not for them, but those for it's been prepared. And the others seem to become indignant, begin to look down upon James and John, you know, for what they've done. Another time as they're traveling, they're talking about themselves, about who's the greatest. And Jesus asks, what were you talking about? And they become silent because they know they shouldn't be. The whole question is shockingly inappropriate. This is Jesus' last time with them before his death. He's just instituted the Lord's Supper. It's a sacrament meant to display peace and unity and harmony. His death is going to take place shortly. I can't imagine how disappointing and how heart-wrenching it must have been for Jesus to go through this, knowing what lies ahead. And they're talking about who's going to have the better seat. But I wonder how often do we do the same things? How often our self-centeredness and our pride, it gets in the way of what we do and what we're thinking about. Secondly, Jesus reminds his disciples in verse 25 of the world's thinking about greatness. The kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them, and those in authority over them are called benefactors, or maybe it's better translated, get themselves called benefactors. And if you look at the two Greek words that that word benefactor comes from, it's really the word do and gooders. They're the do-gooders. And the ancient kings generally wield great and absolute authority. They could sentence a person to death. They could take about as much wealth of the nation as they wanted. And they liked to take credit if they had a building project or whatever it was, the walls of the city. Oh, how great they were. And today we still think in terms of greatness in those same sort of terms. It's in terms of power and wealth and fame. You become a noted actor or singer. Maybe it's in terms of athletic prowess or being on Wall Street and making a fortune. Or as we just had our elections, becoming President of the United States. You think of the survey of Harvard MBA graduates. They were asked a simple question as they were preparing to get the diplomas. What do I hope to achieve in my life after graduation? The number one priority among these MBAs was wealth. Number two was notoriety. Didn't even have to be good notoriety, be just notoriety. And number three was status. What none mentioned on their surveys, not a single one, was the idea of serving others. Well, how many Christians think of greatness in those same terms as the world thinks about greatness? I mean, that can even be in the church. We think about how great we are at preaching or teaching, about how spiritual I am, how upright and upstanding I am in my Christian walk, or how much insight I have, or how hardworking I am. And we view ourselves as great because of that. Maybe secretly. The second point that Jesus makes is that we have the wrong definition of greatness. As you look at verses 26 to 28, he says, "But not so with you." That way of greatness, that way of thinking about what greatness is not to be part of the Christian. The one who serves like the youngest, the one who serves like the person who waits on the table, that's the person who is greatest. Now, the youngest in that day and age was by definition considered to be the least important. They did the worst tasks. I think we maybe get a little sense of that in like the NFL when they go to training camp and the rookies are treated as the lowliest. You know, they have to carry the equipment for the veterans and sing the alma mater fight songs and all the rest that makes them feel their place. This is a whole different mindset. This is, I'm to look out for others. I'm to seek to serve them. It's not without rewards, Jesus goes on to tell them in verses 29 and 30. I assign, and really that's the word, I make a covenant with you, as my Father made a covenant with me, a kingdom. And as a father has given a kingdom to his son, so Jesus gives his flowers that they may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom and sit on thrones judging, or maybe better, ruling the 12 tribes of Israel. When you come across that 12 tribes, it means really the entire people of God. But that promise isn't just for the 12 apostles. It's given to each of Jesus' disciples. Each one who believes in him will be at that great banquet feast at the end of the age, will be in heaven. The third point, our main focus, is the greatest of all leaders, the greatest of all servants, was Jesus of Nazareth. And we can see that in four ways. First, in verse 27, Jesus says, "I'm among you as the one who serves." What had Jesus just done an hour or two before? Well, when none of the others were willing to do so, he had gone around and washed the disciples' feet. He had been a servant to them. He had showed them what it meant to be a servant. And as you think about his entire earthly ministry, what had it been? Well, it had been an extended time of service. He met the spiritual needs of people. He went around preaching and teaching. He met their physical needs. He healed various diseases. He fed large crowds. And so his life is really given by serving others. And at points he was so busy in doing so that he couldn't even eat. As you may remember, when his family wanted to take him away, because they tell you he was crazy. The second way in which we see his service and his greatness is in verse 32. Jesus serves the needs of his disciples by praying for them. And we have at the beginning of that verse that repetition, "Simon, Simon." It solemnly emphasizes what he's going to say to Peter. "Peter, you're still too much the old man. You need to listen carefully to what I'm going to say." Now what's not clear in the English, but it's very clear in the Greek, as Jesus begins to talk to Simon and says, "Satan demanded to have you, that you is plural, that he might sift you all like wheat." So as Jesus is talking about Satan's demand, it isn't just for Peter. He addresses his remarks to Peter, but it's about what all the apostles are going to go through. They're going to go through a time of great difficulty, a time of a severe testing of their faith. And Peter, is going to deny him three times. But all the apostles are going to desert Jesus. They're going to deny him in some way. They're going to go through a dark time. They're going to go through that Saturday when Jesus is in the grave and they have no hope. And notice the content of Jesus' prayer. It's not, I pray that Satan will leave you alone. Or, Peter, I pray that you will avoid sinning. Or I pray that you will have just a nice and full and easy future ahead of you. Rather, his prayer is that your faith may not fail. It's going to be sorely tested, but it won't fail because Jesus has prayed for it. As we think about the focus of Satan attacks, it's always in terms of faith. They're wanting to get people to deny the faith, act in a fearful manner, not in faith. How often did Jesus spend a whole night in prayer, praying for disciples, praying for the advancement of his kingdom? In Hebrews 7:25 reminds us that Jesus is able to save to the uttermost those who draw near to God through him. Why? Since he always lives to make intercession for them. So Jesus had prayed for Peter, but he's praying for you and for me right now. And what is he praying? Well, I think especially what he prayed for Peter, that your faith might not fail and my faith may not fail. What comfort that is as we go through hard times, as we go through our times of distress and hardships, knowing that we're not alone, that Jesus is praying for us and praying that our faith would not fail. Thirdly, we can see in verses 35 to 38, Jesus serves his disciples by pointing them to spiritual realities. Now, previously, remember that Jesus, and he talks about when he sent out the 12, they weren't to take anything with them. They were to go out ministering, trusting for God's provision. But now they're told to take a money bag and a knapsack and to buy a sword if necessary. Well, what's the difference? Well, Jesus refers in verse 37 to Isaiah 53:12, which predicts the death of the Messiah for sinners, that he's going to be numbered with the transgressors. It's pointing to his atoning death, where he carries our sins with him. After that, his work will be accomplished. He'll be raised again. He'll show himself for 40 days. But after that, these apostles will be the focal attack of Satan's attack on them. And just like when we killed bin Laden, the U.S. went after the number two man. And when we killed him, we went after the number three. Jesus is letting his disciples know that they will be in a situation of grave danger. Now they're thinking physically, and they produce two swords. And Jesus' comment, it is enough, is not saying, well, two swords is enough. But enough of this conversation, enough about thinking about things in a physical. It's a spiritual warfare that I want you to be thinking about. And later, Peter tries to use a sword at the betrayal, and Jesus says, put your sword into its sheath. Jesus wants the apostles, and he wants us to be aware of the spiritual battle. And what are the weapons? Well, Paul talks about it in Ephesians 6, the full armor of God. Those are the weapons we need for the spiritual battle. And lastly, the greatest act of service showing Jesus' greatness is the cross, verses 41 to 46. I already mentioned Isaiah 53 being numbered with the transgressions and pointing to a substitute atonement, Jesus bearing the sins of his people. It's the greatest act of service in the history of the world. The greatest act of greatness. But realize it wasn't an easy matter. We see Jesus in his humanity wanting to shrink back from such an awful death. He knew the pain that awaited him. He knew the separation from the Father that would take place. And so quite naturally, he says, "Father, if you're willing, remove this cup from me." It was not an easy task he would have to do that day. And yet, notice the focus of his prayer. It's on the Father's will, not his own. Not that they had different wills, but in his humanness, he did not want to undergo death. But he's willing to do what was necessary. He consents to go through that painful and shameful death of the cross. And notice this is the difference between Jesus, who consents to give his life, from the numerous animal sacrifices that are found in the Old Testament and even into the New Testament. They could never give consent, but Jesus did. And in some ways, this is where the real battle is found. Because as Jesus is delivered in the hands of men, there's a chain of events that lead up to the cross. Now at any point he could have called down a legion of angels and interrupted it. But at this point, he commits himself to do the Father's will and does not look back. You might note in passing, he twice tells his disciples to pray they not enter into temptation. And that's still a very valid prayer for us. Jesus prays that our faith will not fail. We should be praying that we don't enter into temptation. Well, how do we think about greatness? It's often in terms of might and fame and wealth and position and power. But in the church, it's rather the person who serves. The person who cleans the church building. The person who watches the children in the nursery. Who counts the money. Who shows hospitality. That's greatness. As you humbly would do those things. And of course, we look to the greatest example of greatness, of Jesus Christ, who came not to be served, but to serve and give his life as ransom for many. Now, thank you for listening. This is Pastor Bill Roberts of the Terre Haute Reformed Presbyterian Church. We invite you to join us each Sunday morning at 10:45 a.m. We have Bible classes for all ages at 9:30 a.m. You can find us on the web at www.terrehauterpchurch.org. That's www.terrehaute written out, then the initials R and P, and then church written out, .org. Thank you for listening.